Good on you. Okay. And this is sent out to everyone who is will be on the email list. Today, a couple of months, a few weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, my good friend John Stockdyke here finally managed to pronounce his name. I've been saying Stockdyke for so long. Suggested that we have a debate over brain and mind. And the if I understood the question correctly, it's a bit late if I didn't, isn't it? The issue is, can we explain the mind through the brain alone, or is it something else? Are we arguing the same thing?
Close enough,
okay. Brain mind problem, are they the same or are they different? Are they separate? Now, we said we would toss a coin. Do you have any coins? I'm skins. Anyone? Really? I don't have any coins.
I got it.
Okay. No, we got it. We trust nothing. Anyone got? We got. To the rescue.
There's a coin for you.
Okay.
I don't know if you can tell which side is heads or tails.
Yeah. We've never met before, right?
Is this a
Do you want to hit the? Put the coin?
Actually, yesterday. A bigger one?
Oh, did we? Okay.
Yeah. So I'm a supporter. Whoops. So maybe.
All right. So,
what do you want me to do?
Just flip the coin. Wait, we'll say.
But, Philip, this coin doesn't have a heads or tails. It's a Mexican coin.
Oh, I see. So it's eagles and what's the other side? Eagles.
That's bigger.
Aguilas and.
You got an eagle and you got a number.
Okay, wait a minute. We gotta go first. Which? Heads, John goes first. No, eagles.
When you look at numbers.
Eagle, John goes first.
Okay, the coin's gone.
Anyone got another coin? There's some financial shenanigans going on here.
Hey, ready?
I hope he's doing it.
Okay, and eagles is John first. The other side is me first.
It's an eagle.
John's foe. The format is going to be that John's going to speak for 20 minutes, I'm going to speak for 20 minutes, we'll have a brief rebuttal, time for rebuttal, and then it's a free-for-all. Everyone's going to be able to ask questions and put in their 2 pesos worth. Okay, take it away, John.
Thank you, Phil. The first thing I have to do is correct Phil. When I approached him a few weeks ago, I suggested to Phil that we co-present and have a discussion. But that word debate, people love the word debate. So I tried several times to deflect the word debate unsuccessfully. Finally, reluctantly, I agreed to accept the word debate. But one of the things I'm going to do in my presentation is explain why debate on this subject makes no sense. That'll be part of my presentation. So you might find me quite reluctant to debate. I like to start with why is the question, what is mind important? There was a survey of 100,000 mental health professionals. And they were surveyed and asked that in their training, these are psychologists, psychiatrists, therapists, the whole field. They were asked, in your training, did anyone ever explain to you what the mind is? And only 5% of professionals in the field had ever been exposed to an explanation of what the mind is. That is very revealing. That alone is reason to address the question, because how can you deal with mental health, the mind, if you do not have a definition of what mind is?
What year was that?
I don't have the year, Bill.
I think it's kind of a mindless question.
Let's save our discussion for later. The second reason I would like to raise, I'm not going to spend any time on because it's a whole topic by itself, and that is the existential risk from artificial intelligence. If we don't know what a mind in a human being is and how a brain generates the mind, how can we be certain what a computer is going to do? So there are very serious people, very concerned about an artificial intelligence, a super intelligence, developing it wouldn't be a human mind because we're biological. It would be some kind of alien mind, but possibly a mind that is has some similarities in the sense of being able to act with intention, what we would call free will. So I'm going to park that. That's a whole big topic, but it's out there. It might even be a bigger risk than global warming. I mean, we simply do not know. We don't talk about it because we don't know enough to talk about it, but some very serious people are having that discussion. The third reason why I think the topic is important, it's certainly why it's important to me, is understanding ourselves. And there's great debate out there on the value of subjective experience and objective knowledge. And this pertains to that debate as well. How valuable is subjective experience contrasted with objective facts? I want to present some history, and this is why debating doesn't make sense, because this, the mind-body problem has been debated for 2,500 years, and we have not yet solved it. So, you know, where are Phil and I in relation to the last 2,500 years? I don't think we register. But we're not going to pick up the story back with the ancients. I'll pick up the history with only a few things, and I'm really cherry picking because there's too much to compress into a 20-minute presentation. 1974. Thomas Nagel wrote an article called What Is It Like to Be a Bat? That article is still intensely discussed today. A very good article, required reading in first-year philosophy courses. In 1991, Daniel Dennett wrote a book called Consciousness Explained. Okay, Daniel Dennett claims to have the problem solved. That is under a lot of discussion. His book is sometimes made fun of by saying that his book should be entitled Consciousness Explained Away. But that's just a little poke at him, and he's able to give as good as he gets. In 1974, there was a significant development. It was the launch of the Science of Consciousness conferences. Out of the University of Arizona. They are held every 2 years. They're ongoing. It really is the who's who on the science of consciousness from around the world. If you want to get a quick picture of how little any of us know about the topic, just read the program and read the abstracts of the papers. It is overwhelming, but there are the world's best thinkers on the topic there. I think it was at the second conference in 96, I may have the date wrong, a man said something that is still talked about. He used words that really gripped people, and that was David Chalmers, and he described the problem as the hard problem of consciousness. And we still talk about the hard problem of consciousness. David Chalmers is an Australian philosopher and one of the who's who of the whole topic. So these are just three of many people that are experts on the topic. I'm not. I don't think Phil is, but we'll see.
Definitely not.
And if you can figure out in the debate, because all of these people disagree with each other, there is not a consensus, which is why the problem isn't solved. All extremely bright, highly educated, thoughtful thinkers, all worth reading and studying, but there's no agreement amongst them. So that in itself is an interesting observation. Just to give you a flavor of the ongoing debate, there was an article in 2013, and it was entitled The Heretic. And the subject of the article was Thomas Nagel. And it says, who is Thomas Nagel and why are so many of his fellow academics condemning him? I mean, these people don't just disagree. They
yes.
They get into it. In the New York Review of Books, Thomas Nagel published an article, Is Consciousness an Illusion? That was in the March 2007 issue. And it was a book review of Daniel Dennett's latest book, From Bacteria to Bach and Back, The Evolution of Minds by Daniel Dennett, his latest offering. So this is a little bit, a tiny little bit of the landscape. I can't get this into 20 minutes. Start cutting material. Okay, again, just to make the point why it is futile for Phil and I to debate this, there is a database that collects papers written by philosophers called the Phil Papers. It has over 2 million papers. The section Philosophy of Mind has over 92,000 papers. If you take a subset of that, the Philosophy of Consciousness, that has 29,000 papers. If you take a subset of that and talk about theories of consciousness, you are now down to 2,400 papers. And if you take a subset of that, you get something called Functionalist Theories of Consciousness. There are 275 papers. And then you get down to something called Dennett's Functionalism. His theory of consciousness actually has a name, Dennett's Functionalism. 118 papers just on that. So it's too much. I read a few articles written by a few writers who read some of these papers. And that's how I form my opinions. That's honest, eh?
That's all you can do.
That's all you can do. So if Phil, I'm going to poison the well here. If Phil gets up and says he's an expert, well, be skeptical. Now, I'm talking about philosophy. A lot of you in the room probably prefer to hear about science. So what's going on in neuroscience? There is more going on in the world of neuroscience today than any single human being can keep up with. Okay, so it is not possible to know everything anymore. It cannot be done. It is beyond human capacity. The Society for Neuroscience, this is only one narrow piece of science. The Society of Neuroscience is 38,000 members. If even only 1,000 of them are writing good articles, what chance do we have? Okay, now, I'm going to express some opinions, but I want it clear that these are just opinions by somebody who does some reading in an area of interest. I do want to poke holes in reductionism. So there are those who believe that you can reduce the mind to the brain. The mind is nothing more than brain activity. So let's go down that road. Are you listening, Phil?
I'm listening, don't worry.
Okay, so we can reduce the brain. We can reduce the brain to brain cells. And we can reduce brain cells to molecules, and we can reduce molecules to atoms, and we can reduce atoms to protons, neutrons, and electrons. Pretty good reduction, right? Then what do we reduce those to? That's where chemistry was at when I went to high school. They've gone further now. We can reduce that to something called quarks, elementary particles. What are they? Oh, what are quarks? Quark, what is it?
Small.
Yeah, they're very small. Okay. Now, if you begin to look into that, first of all, it's very hard to understand physics at that level. It's very hard to understand. And if you can find some people who write at a level that we can understand, you find out there is no agreement. So, is a quark a point? Because there are people who are saying it is a point. You don't need anything more than a zero-dimension, point-like building block, a quark, to build the universe. Now, if you understand that, it may be true. I'm not saying this is not true. I'm not disparaging this. These are brilliant physicists. So there is, a quark could be a point. or to be a vibrating string, you know, there is no consensus on what elementary particles are made of. So you're building a brain out of something that is not understood. So in my opinion, reductionism utterly fails. What is also clear is that this is beyond the reach, beyond the reach of the average person. So when we talk about brain-mind, we're really out of our league, but it's important because we all think we have a mind, right? I think we agree on that. I'm really watching my time. Okay, I want to try to make a distinction between physical and mental. And my key point is that when we talk about the mind, we are talking about something that includes something that is unknown. So we haven't got the words to talk about it. We can try, we can paint pictures, we need to talk about it, but when you're into the unknown, by definition, you're into something that is beyond our grasp. So words are inadequate, but that's what we have, right? That's how we communicate language, so we have to use words, even when they're inadequate. So let's say the physical is that which can be explained by physics, okay? Reasonable definition. The mental is that which cannot be explained by physics. So my point is that the mind activity cannot be fully explained by physics. It needs the brain. It doesn't exist independent of the brain, but it is something more, something different. So I'm going to take a cut at what the mind is, but I'm not going to take the approach that this is truth, that it necessarily conforms with what is real and with reality. I think it is important not to contradict known science. So science is extremely important. When something begins to contradict known science, I'm not a believer. But you can make statements about the mind that cannot be explained by physics and that do not contradict known science. So, so not inconsistent with known science. And I'll give my sources. I'll give my sources. And I want to pick up on a couple of points. Ooh, the clock is ticking. I'll be begging for time. Okay, we can think of the mind as a non-physical, self-organizing, complex system. So when you get into systems theory, a lot of that is useful for the mind. The mind is embodied. I'm certainly not going to advocate anything that the mind is independent of the brain. The mind is a loop. Okay, this is actually a very interesting point that differentiates mind and brain, because the brain generates the mind. Don't think there's anything doubt about that. But the mind can shape the brain. Okay, and that brain that has been shaped can in turn influence the mind. So better to think of a loop here, that we go brain, mind, which includes something we don't understand, which influences the brain. The science of being able to change the brain with thought, I think, is pretty close to established science. So there's something going on. If that is true, that is the only thing in the physical universe that can affect itself somehow. And that cannot be explained by the laws of physics. That is something other than physical. The mind has many elements. It's complex. It comes from the most complex thing in the universe, the brain, but so it must also be complex. It's more than just our consciousness. There is an unconscious element, there is a subconscious element, and a non-conscious element. So there are these elements to the brain, to the mind. The mind is the home of our subjective experience, our sense of self, and our sense of knowing. The mind, and again, this is in contrast to physics, the mind can be irrational. Physics is very, very rational. The mind can be irrational. So it cannot be physical in the sense of explainable by physics. At least it's reasonable to present it that way. And I'm going to argue that the mind has free will. And what I mean by that is an ability to act with intention and not necessarily driven by the physical thing that that emerges from. Here's something to think about. If we make the statement that we have no free will, try proving that the unconscious mind has no free will. That's a serious thought to think about. Okay, you might make an argument that the conscious mind has no free will, but how do you know that that conscious mind doesn't have underneath it other layers that are unconscious or subconscious, and that that entity, which is part of us, part of me, has free will? But I would also make the argument that the conscious mind has free will. I certainly came here of my own free will, and I'm acting with intention. I do want to talk about one of the phrases that, I've got 1 minute left. One of the phrases that drives me up the wall, and that is the self is an illusion. I'm not an illusion. I don't think any of you are. They mean something different, but if you mean something different, say something different. There is a lot of confusion around the self, and to have an understanding of the self, we must have an understanding of the mind, which I would suggest is not possible. So there will be an element of ourselves that we do not understand. And I am out of my allotted 20 minutes. Oh, I got 10 seconds. I will. I am content to know certain things intuitively. So I don't expect any of you to believe what I believe intuitively, but that is enough for me to be confident in my own knowledge.
Okay, thank you. Excellent, John. Inadequate, but excellent. I must admit, I was a bit intimidated when, you know, I got this couple of papers here. I saw John's.
You got it all up
I
here.
Saw John's.
I need it here. You got it here.
And I wasn't going to bring up Dennett, but I looked at his book too, and I want to paraphrase this because he was talking about qualia, our subjective experience. But he said, we don't actually think, we only think we think. Which I thought was very profound. Well, obviously, I have a few issues with what John has had to say. And my approach is going to be a lot more physical than mental. I'm going to, first of all, just talk about what the brain is, you know, that 3-pound wet mush that we all have housed in our skull. It's 90 billion neurons. And the connections, each one connects to multiple other neurons. So the connections are just staggering. And basically, a neuron is just a conduit for impulses. They start and terminate with, some neuron and they end up in another neuron. That is it. It's an organ of semi-compartmentalized anatomy, but integrated function. And it is the most complex thing we know about in the universe. But then you have to wonder, who's telling me that? Now, the brain is always active. These impulses, they don't start spontaneously. In your third, probably correct me on this thing, third, fourth month in gestation, you begin to see some neural activity, maybe earlier than that, I don't know. And it doesn't stop until you're brain dead, until that last neuron fires. There's two types of activity based on awareness. You have your subconscious. We all know we have subconscious. You know that the heart is regulating your heart rate and your blood pressure and sweating and your sleep and your, you know, just your balance and all these things. We're aware it does, but we're not really conscious of it actually doing it. On the other hand, we also have our conscious, this conscious activity, decision-making, emotions, cognition, thinking, feeling, wanting, morals, values. These seem very hard to explain in the physical world. But all those, and these actions can be either swallowing, movement, learned skills. And when we consider states that we can experience, we aggregate those functions into something we call the mind. Now, the difference between the mind and the brain, this issue has been pondered since the Greeks, probably before then. And the nature of, there's been many explanations, and they continue to this day. Even with the advent of neuroscience, it hasn't really slowed down the new theories on brain and mind. And no one would claim, at least I hope, no one would claim that they're not different. I don't think the brain is the mind. I don't think the mind is the brain. My contention is that the mind is a phenomenon of the brain. It is completely reliant on the brain, and I don't believe we need any further explanations to describe the mind other than it arises out of the brain. And so the question is, does it require a metaphysical explanation? You know, can the mind be fully explained by the function of the brain, or is there something special about mind that cannot be explained by simple reductive materialism? And if there is something else, something extra, can we describe that in any objective way? I mean, it certainly feels that we have something extra than the physical world. It certainly is a strong feeling, much like free will. But it's obvious that there exists some connection between... And I didn't say... Oh, you didn't start the timer for me, did you? There exists some connection or some interface between the two. And there are many beliefs about the interaction between brain and mind. For example, this panpsychism, which basically says that awareness and is really a consciousness, is a property of everything in the universe, no matter how small. And we either possess that property, or we tap into that property as some. Some believe that the mind is in complete control, and that we're basically, you know, we're the puppet, the mind is the master. Others believe in some sort of two-way communication between the mind and the brain. The mind can alter the brain can alter the mind. And there are some which believe that really the mind is a passenger on the brain train, right? It goes along for the ride, but it really doesn't have anything to do with steering or anything like that. And some of these explanations involve non-material entities, non-physical realms and dimension. Something else has to be there, because the physical part, the material part, cannot explain it all. Now, I will readily agree with John that we really don't know which is true. But that doesn't mean that all explanations are equally likely, or that any explanation is an equal contender. There's been a lot of recent neurological activity, and a lot of recent evidence has begun to tip the balance to one explanation. And the fact that the mechanism as to how quantifiable material actions in the brain produce non-quantifiable thoughts are not understood, and may never be understood. But it should not impact on the relationship between brain and mind. History is replete with poor explanations of once mysterious events. You know, the volcano explodes, you don't know the underlying reason, you give it a metaphysical explanation. But if we have an observable correlation between brain and mind, then the lack of knowledge as to the mechanism of awareness should not impact our confidence of that correlation. In other words, if we can correlate brain and mind successfully, does the explanation of how it works, is that really important? My contention, it should be enough, and then nothing extra is needed. So before we look at the correlation, a quick look at how the brain functions. So it's electrical impulses traveling along the neurons as a result of a change in cell wall permeability and a movement of sodium and potassium ions through that cell membrane. These ions behave according to the laws of physics. When the impulse needs to jump from one neuron to another, this is done biochemically with substances such as dopamine, serotonin, acetylcholine, for neurotransmitters. And these are released at the end of one neuron due to that arrival of that potential change. They cross a gap, they hit the next neuron, and they create the next change in potential, and the signal and the impulse is carried forward. Now, these neurotransmitters, they fit into receptors on the neurons. They behave in a very predictable way, obeying the laws of physics and biology. And collectively, this whole thing is known as brain activity. Well, when did the first impulse start? In the embryo, and it doesn't stop until then. I hope I can go 20 minutes on this. The question is, does the mind influence this? Now, if the physics of the way the mind operates did not behave in a predictable manner, we'd observe two things. The first, we'd be able to see it. We'd be able to observe this. Secondly, the brain could not function. There's no room for the unpredictable. There's no room for the spontaneous firing of neurons. It is incredibly well organized. But if you were to measure all the particles, ions, molecules, maybe even quarks, in your brain and observe that they were all obeying the laws of physics, then this would mean that the purported non-physical mind is having no effect. But if you observe that these particles are not moving around due to physics, but instead were being pushed around and influenced by the mind, then that would bring the mind into the domain of physics, because now you can measure the forces that the mind is exerting and study the properties physically, just as you would with any new field or any new particle. Is there any evidence that the brain is influenced or controlled by a non-physical force? I don't know of any. Is there any part of the mind that cannot be changed or influenced by changes in or to the brain? I don't believe so. Is there any model of the brain that cannot explain the changes to mind or consciousness? I can only think of general anesthesia. I don't believe they actually know how general anesthesia works. But you look at well, we know it works. Thankfully. But I think the actual underlying biochemistry, and Stephen, you'd be in a position to correct me if I was wrong, I still think that the jury is out on the exact mechanism of general anesthesia.
I don't think that, I can't answer it.
Okay. Well, believe me then. But we know from other, psychopharmacology that there is a lot of the biochemical underpinning of brain activity that is well understood. If you have, we'll go into the effects later on that we can very easily observe. We can observe changes to the brain and subsequent changes to the mind through psychopharmacology. You can, if you have an anxious mind, Valium works quite well. If you're depressed, there are serotonin uptake receptor inhibitors. If you're feeling a little anxious, alcohol does a great job.
Yeah.
If you need a little mental boost, Ritalin is a drug of choice from. So your cognition, your fears, if you want to challenge even your mind's view of reality, there's lots of hallucinogens that can do the trick quite nicely. Your mind is really so easily manipulated biochemically, with ready explanations in the brain, that it's hard to imagine that there's something else in the brain that is influencing that process. The studies of strokes and brain lesions has given us incredible insights into how the brain functions. What is the effect on the mind when there is damage to part of the brain, or when there is a traumatic lesion or a stroke? And personality, if anyone's known anyone with a stroke, I mean, personality changes, they're not rare. They suffer some damage and their personality changes. It'd be remiss of me not to include the story of Phineas Gage. I'm not sure whether you're familiar with this gentleman back in the 19th century.
The gun.
He was a railroad engineer. And he was a very well-respected engineer worked for the railroad, and they were drilling boreholes, and he was tamping the powder down, and with a big long tamping iron, and it exploded. It went up through his cheek and came out through the top of his head, and landed 10 meters away. It knocked him on his back. He had a few convulsions, but he never lost consciousness. He was still aware. And he actually went home before the doctor saw him. And he was sat on his porch when the doctor arrived. Fascinating story. But the point is, he recovered eventually from this damage, which was extensive. Afterwards, they said his friends and acquaintances and workers, he had to be released from the railroad. He said, He is not the same person. He is impulsive. He's lost his inhibitions. Many is in public, but he doesn't know how to behave himself in public. And he was a lost soul. This was due to the physical damage. His mind was completely, there was no part of his mind that was observing this in him. He had actually changed. Another one, I was talking about he had a propensity for gambling. There are a couple of drugs out in the market now which carry warnings about gambling. I think Ropiranol is one. Do you know the other one?
I haven't heard of it before.
It comes with a warning label. And you're more likely to gamble and be promiscuous.
That's a good excuse.
Yeah.
And what's the drug supposed to be?
Yeah, what drug is that?
There's one.
Can you get this?
For anxiety.
Can you get this?
but things we consider, that we have good control over, that our mind is in control, are so easily influenced by a few molecules here and there. They also was, I'm sure you know Libet's experiments on free will. Well, Libet had a friend, a contemporary called Itzhak Fried, and he was a neurosurgeon, and he used to he did a lot of work on epilepsy, and part of the process for the underlying theme behind treating epilepsy is that you want to ablate or destroy the part of the brain that's causing the seizures, but leave as much as possible intact. And there's a lot of, probing to find out, to try and either trigger the epilepsy or at least know what you might be damaging. And they put a lot of probes in there. The patient is conscious. They'll, take the lid off, take a little part out, and they'll put little probes in. They'll stimulate them and ask the patient, what do you feel? Well, Fried was very fascinated because he would find a neuron or a series of neurons that, when stimulated, would provoke mirth. And the degree of the potential of stimulation was relatable to the degree of joy and happiness that person felt. Now, what happened was he stimulated and they smiled a little bit more and they laughed. He said, well, why are you laughing? And the person, although they never really knew why, they would they would invent a reason. Your hair's funny. That person, you know, is, your tie's hilarious. They would never confess that they didn't know. The mind could not conceive of having an external stimulus provoking something of which it wasn't in control. So the illusion of control of the mind, I think, is quite readily demonstrated in Itzhak's work. I'm about off to, aren't I? So how those changes, how all these changes end up as subjective awareness is a mystery and may never be solved. I readily admit that. I've seen models of explanations of consciousness. There is an anesthesiologist called Hammerhoff. He's talking about quantum entanglement in microtubules in the neurons. If it's right or wrong, I don't think it will ever improve our understanding of why that makes us conscious. Because it is a mystery, there's no reason to invent explanations outside of the realm of physical material. The only question is there anything in the mind that cannot be said to have a correlate in the brain? Does John know? What does he think he knows? That's right. All right, so now we're going to have a little... you've got a rebuttal?
Well, for a couple of minutes.
This wasn't in the rules.
We were going to ask each other questions, but...
Oh, yeah, okay. That's fair enough,
A few more comments, and then you get the last word. Is that...
Whatever.
The last word's
We'll finish. We're only going to be a few more minutes, and then we're going to open it up for everybody, because you folks will want to say things and have questions. So I'll make a... couple of more minutes, fill a couple of more minutes, and then open season, however we go. The first thing I would say is I probably agree with 95% of what Phil said. So I want to emphasize the agreement, not the disagreement.
But it was 98 before I spoke.
And I think the fundamental important point that I agree with is that we agreed that what we're talking about is a mystery. I have lots of room for people who see this as mysterious. What concerns me is when people speak dogmatically, when dogmatism isn't justified. And I did not hear that in Phil, so I got lots of room for him.
Saving it to the last words.
He refuted a couple of points I did not make. I never... talked about something extra. I talked about an unknown, possibly an unknown, an unknowable, a mystery. So all of his talk about something extra, yeah, some people make that argument. I did not make that argument. The idea of the mind having complete control is also an argument I did not make. Everything Phil said about the impact of chemicals on the brain is true. To assert that the mind is in complete control is a huge overstatement. The claim I made is that the mind is sufficient to act independently and not be 100% influenced by brain states. That's the point I made. That's a different point than he was arguing against. The neural correlates of consciousness, okay? If we look at the number of brain cells, the number of connections, and if we model that, we will have more brain states than the number of atoms in the universe. So, neuroscience is making tremendous, valuable progress in understanding neural correlates. To think that we can ever reach a point where that results in something meaningful, they're scratching the surface. There are more brain states than atoms in the universe, in any one brain. So we're dealing with something that is really beyond the capacity of known science to model. So think of everybody in this room for a moment. Suppose that we were all now being subject to a brain scan and our neural firings were being monitored. And if we all concentrate on exactly the same thought or the same thing, will the pattern be exactly the same? No, it will not. There will be areas of the brain that respond similarly. So there are some correlates, but to make the assertion that any thought or any mental activity can be exactly the same, and if you're going to explain physically, ultimately, unless it's exactly the same, what meaning does it have? So to solve this mystery is certainly beyond the science that we know today. I don't think I really have any more comments. That's enough.
The last word.
Okay.
The last word. Sorry, personal.
Okay. John claims he didn't mention anything about something extra. But then he implied that reductionism wasn't enough. So which is it, John?
It's not an either or.
So I would argue that if you can't explain it with what you have, and you're suggesting that what you have is not enough to explain it, you are implying that there is something else. And this is very fortunate having the last word, isn't it? I just have to watch you shake your head, don't I? But anyway, that's my take on you know, whether there's something extra. And I'm not saying that John really did state that explicitly, but there are a lot of theories of mind where people do look upon something beyond the physical realm to explain consciousness. And thankfully, John didn't really go there. The question of this, the neural correlates, the example John gave of everyone having the same thought but exhibiting different patterns is not unsurprising at all, given the fact that we all have plastic, you know, the brain is a very plastic organ. We've all been subject to different experiences. We all have different genetic makeup. It would astound me if they were even, you know, close in any specificity. But if you thought about the same thing a second time, would they match? My contention is they would. If you think about, you know, a glass of Coke, then tomorrow when I think about that glass of Coke, apart from the changes that have happened between now and then, it should really be invoking the same pattern.
Depends on the kind of it.
Yeah, it does. So yeah, yeah, you're right. You're right. I won't go into the Jennifer Aniston. I don't really heard about that.
The what?
The Jennifer Aniston.
Now you have to tell me.
Neuron.
Yeah.
What is that?
I'll have to look that up because I came across it and skipped by it. But there's a specific.
If you were able to identify the single neuron that if it stimulated it, you would think of Jennifer.
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah. Got
that's all it took was one neuron.
That's about right.
Even if you don't know.
Even if you don't know who she is? No. I mean, obviously not. But even if they're saying that the idea of
she's a porn star, right?
We wish.
But I mean, that's, yeah. When the person has that neuron.
So I would say that, and this really, you know, touches on the free will aspect, that we are basically products of our physiology. There's nothing extra. There's no soul. There's no ghost in the machine. We are blind. We are the result of blind forces.
Fact or opinion? Fact or opinion?
Well, it's my opinion. Isn't
okay,
it?
That's
it's,
fine.
You know,
that's
my opinion fine. That it's a fact.
Well, there you go.
I think it's better to say that we are products of our experiences.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I would not disagree with that. You know, we're talking about how much we should get into free will. Is my little pet project, but it just echoes the fact that we are subject to forces that we cannot appreciate, and our mind really is so mysterious that to try and even contemplate
you
it is
so
difficult.
You should put the word "yet" to it, because
obviously.
Because I think, you know, this science is going unbelievably fast.
Yes.
You know, my grandson is in cell biology, and he goes to Stanford once in a while, where they examine individual cells. And they use some nuclear device for that. Costs $1 million a shot.
Yeah.
And so it may be slowed down, but there's not enough money. But it is. I mean, this is a field that's so beyond, you know, the knowledge so far. But I think that he's not the only one that's doing it, obviously.
And they've learned more in the last 30 years than all the time up to now.
And it goes faster all the time because there are more and more people working on it. There are more and more people to begin with.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll sit down. I've done my say.
I have an observation that you and John both seem to be talking about something that's out beyond what we know, but you have different words for it.
Mm-hmm.
Can you clarify the difference that you're saying? That John's saying there's something unknown out there, and you're saying there's something. What's your language?
No, I'm saying.
So you guys are the same.
The experience is a mystery.
Isn't the mystery you're talking about the same thing that John's talking about when he talks about the unknown? Something extra is there other than our conscious and what we're aware of at this point in culture.
We're closer than
yeah.
So
you guys are twin brothers, and you each have a leg you're walking on.
Our big difference really seems to be around the idea of free will.
But that's not what the discussion is about.
But it flows from that.
But the discussion. Okay, I'm sorry.
I heard John say, "Mental is not physics. Mental cannot be explained by physics. There's physical and there's mental, and mental cannot be explained by physics." Phil is saying mental can be explained by physics.
But he doesn't explain
mental
it.
Mental is physical. We don't have the explanation yet.
But it's observable.
Because of the high correlation,
but,
we're pretty confident. And that we're pretty confident that it can, that it.
Oh, but,
okay, I won't say it can't be explained, but mental is a result of physical. I heard you say there's something extra, that mental is beyond physical, and I want to know what that is.
No, I'm not quite saying that. What Phil is...
You sound like Trump now.
What Phil is saying, what I'm hearing him say, is a belief that it is explainable physically. But that's future. That's a belief. He's entitled to any belief like that. But
he's saying there's nothing beyond physics, and you're saying there is something. That's the something extra.
Yes,
I'm curious.
I'm saying the mind is beyond physics.
So this comes to the question of disembodied awareness, disembodied consciousness, and disembodied agency, which is God.
Yeah.
I did not go into the disembodied. I'm talking about the human mind fully
if
embodied.
If it's not physical, it's disembodied. If it has no physical correlates, where you can look at electrons binding with other electrons and, you know, neurons and chemical signals.
The philosophers have described what we're talking about here in specific language. There's something called material monism, something called idealistic monism, something called neutral monism, and something called dualism. Are we familiar with those terms? Material monism says that matter is the fundamental underlying basis of mind. Mm-hmm. Mind arises from matter, and I think that's Phil's position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's another position that says mind is the fundamental reality, and matter is a manifestation of that. And that's called idealistic monism. Mind is the main thing. Neutral monism says that both of these things derive from something else, like space and time derive from space-time. There's something prior that they both derive from. And dualism says that these are two different things that can't be brought together ever. That's Descartes' position, and that might be yours.
No, my position is that all of what you've described are at this time possible, and my ultimate position is I do not know which one is correct.
Good answer, because they're all logically possible.
Yes.
None can be rolled in, none can be rolled
out.
Yeah. So you have to be agnostic about them all.
That's exactly where I am.
Yeah.
Well said, much better than I said.
But John did say something that
And you said that you can't contradict known science. Mm-hmm. And I disbelieve that, because if we don't contradict known science, we would not advance to another type of science. And I know a Georgia Tech professor I was listening to said to his class every day, what I'm teaching you today is what we consider fact. Tomorrow it might be disproved. So I agree with your comment about you can't contradict known science. But
known science changes daily.
Yeah. Oh, it does, absolutely.
Yeah. No, I fully accept that.
I don't think that's what he meant.
Yeah. But while ever we're now,
yeah, because I was surprised you would say such a thing.
Right?
But there seems to be a connectivity between the brain and the mind, and then a non-connectivity. It seems to me the brain seems to be more independent and the mind more subjective. And I can say to myself with my mind, I want to move my leg. But my leg, brain is not reacting to that. And the brain is not telling my leg to move. And so the smile that you were talking about and the laughter is also a physical response. So if you stimulate that part of the brain, the smile has muscles and things and it makes that reaction, and also the laughter.
Also there was a subjective quality. She felt joy and mirth. She felt happy, you know, from stimulating that. That wasn't just the physical manifestations of being happy. She that was her experience.
I would still disagree with that kind of things, such as dissecting a frog. When you hit a certain nerve, the leg will jump, you know, and it's the same way as hitting a certain nerve in the brain that makes me laugh. Or
the point was that it was a, you can stimulate by physical means, mm-hmm. what seems to be the purview of the mind, of emotional state.
Emotional state. But that's outside the physical thing that then projects that connectivity to the mind to make you feel, oh, I feel good. But that's a small little connectivity. And I do believe the brain is more independent and the mind is more subjective to the environment and everything that's manifests itself to the mind. And the brain is a little bit more stabilized than what the mind, because I can change your mind, but I can't change your brain.
Yes.
I'm curious about the discussion of science versus the metaphysical. Uh-huh. And I'm wondering why the subject of the quantum physics doesn't come in,
because
where the experiment shows clearly, and there have been many experiments done, and that shows that when a thought is introduced into the mix, something occurs that is different than when thought is not introduced. So what that would represent is that thought is causative over the material. Uh-huh.
I also want to mention
a scientist who has been working in this area is Thomas Campbell. Wrote a book called My Big Toe, which is my theory of everything. So he integrates all of the quantum physics into this whole discussion. So I just wanted to throw that out, because we're talking about science, we're talking about non-science, and there's a scientist who's looking at that issue very seriously.
So he's saying that thought is a quantifiable thing that can be
based on influence
something.
Yeah, based on the quantum physics, there's zero evidence. You can look at it.
I have looked at it.
There have been quite a few.
Of course, you can look at lots of things that people believe.
What about the double slit experiment?
The double slit experiment.
That has nothing to do with thought. Controlling things. It's
well,
about whether you're measuring
it's got
or
to
not.
Do with perception.
It's about whether you're not even perception. It's about whether you're making a measurement at the moment that the electron goes through the slit.
One measurement occurs when a human
sure, that's one
consciousness is involved in the issue, and another measurement occurs when that is being withdrawn. And a lot of experiments have been developed to show when there is an observer. A unit that measures.
A measurement is a different thing from an observation.
Well, when it's observed by someone, mm-hmm. the phenomena is different than when it is not observed.
That's
and all of these experiments were designed so that they could isolate when a consciousness observed and when a consciousness didn't observe in that double slit.
If it was that simple, there would be no question among physicists.
Oh, yes.
It depends. That also could be how much that information has been seen by other people. People do their experiments, and other people agree.
Well, then they publish papers in peer-reviewed journals, and things are repeated or not.
When you're talking about consciousness and the quantum wave function collapse, you're talking about Schrodinger's cat more than you are Young's double slit lamp, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't get that.
You're familiar with Schrodinger's cat?
No.
Thought experiment? No?
No.
Oh, well, I don't know if we want to take the time to deal with that.
Yeah, we don't need to get into it. But the thing is, I just wanted to bring that up as
a scientist
who has studied this area from a scientific point of view and his conclusions based on the quantum physics experiments that he's developed and has observed. His conclusion is that thought is boss. Thought creates matter. And in this argument of does the brain cause the mind or does the mind cause the brain? Well,
whose thought created matter? We get back to the thing, whose thought created matter?
What?
If you say, so that doesn't make any sense when you say the thought creates matter. Unless we go back to John's idea that there's more that we don't understand yet that is creating matter.
Well, we have to create it because of the quark remark.
All the matter has been already created.
Yeah.
What?
All the matter is already created.
Who says that? Where do you come up with that idea?
But it has to be developed and
that's
understood.
A nice idea, but
it has to be understood because the quark remark was the debate of whether a point exists in Euclidean geometry. Is it finite or is it infinite? Now, the mind cannot conceive of infinity. So after 45 minutes of discussion among the class, the total class decides that the point exists, the quark, that small little point out there.
But is it a point or does it have some dimension?
Well, that's not, it's a quark. And so because from that point on, that thought, because if you decide not that it exists, then the whole classroom sits there in silence for eternity. You have to decide that it exists because you cannot build from that point. And from that building point, then you create the matter, you create the other areas in which we develop our physics, our science.
I think we're sliding a little off topic.
Unless it exists only in relation to all of the other virtual points that are existing at the same time. And that's what creates the illusion of existence. And not physical points at all, but the interaction among virtual particles popping in and out of the vacuum.
Well, we have to decide that.
Well, we are going to have disagreement, obviously.
Yeah.
You know.
It's not a disagreement. It's just a... Well, it is a disagreement.
Yeah.
I didn't say it.
It seemed like it. It walked like one.
It talks like one.
I encourage people to, express what they have read, what they've studied, what they believe. And I hope we can all listen with respect. And I disagree with you, too. I agree with you.
Can we end on a joke?
Yeah, go on.
To address your question. Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg are driving across Germany on the Autobahn.
He knows the joke.
Yeah. I told this joke here.
You told it? When?
Yeah, a couple months ago, but go ahead, tell it.
Here?
Yeah.
Oh,
nobody heard it.
Okay.
Nobody heard it.
Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg are driving on the Autobahn and they get stopped by a traffic policeman.
Niels Bohr? No, Schrodinger.
Not yet.
Oh, different joke. Okay.
No, same joke. Okay. And a policeman stops him and Heisenberg is driving.
Yeah.
So the policeman says, "Sir, do you have any idea how fast you were going?" And Heisenberg says, "No, not any idea, but I know exactly where I was."
Okay, you have to know Heisenberg's uncertainty principle to get that part of the joke.
We'll get to that. And the cop says, "Well, I can tell you exactly, sir. You were going 148.5 kilometers per hour." And Niels Bohr says, "Well, now we're lost." And then there's a chuckle from the back seat. And the cop turns his head around and he says, "Well, who are you?" And the guy says, "Well, I'm Erwin Schrodinger. This is my car, actually." And the cop says, "Well, perhaps we'd better have a look around." So they get out of the car and they open the trunk and there's a dead cat in the trunk.
Sir, do you know?
And he says, sir, do you know this cat is dead? And Schrodinger says, well, it is now.
Okay, and you have to know Schrodinger's cat to get that part of it.
Can I make a comment?
Yes.
When I came here, I expected that the discussion was going to be over my head, and it was. What I'm surprised by is the number of people who seem to be up to date on some of this idea and some of this research.
You do.
So I'm applauding you all for really paying attention to what's going on in the world. And I like your research, I like the discussion, but I'm just blown away at how many, this may be the only group in this community that's like this, I don't know. I'm very impressed by how many people are keeping up. I've recently been trying to figure out, you know, atomic physics theories and stuff, and I've tried it four times, and I think I'm getting a little closer. So maybe with your help, I'll get there.
Oh, I would like to emphasize too that we'd like the group to be accessible, you know, that you don't need, obviously, to appreciate a joke like that, you're going have to have a little bit of background. But we'd like to keep it accessible that, you know, it's basically to stretch our minds. And I applaud people, anyone who you know, has an opinion that I disagree with. And thank you for sharing that. I disagree. I may not believe it, but, you know, I think it's good that we share it, and at least it'll reinforces my own opinion.
I've got another physics show for you.
Okay,
an ion and a neutron go into a bar. An ion and a neutron.
Neutron.
You can make it a proton if you want. That's a hydrogen ion. And the bartender says to the proton, he goes, why do you look so upset? He goes, I just lost my electron. He goes, are you sure? He goes, I'm positive. Wait. Then the neutron asks, how much do I owe you? And the bartender says, for you, no charge.
A little more accessible joke. Niels Bohr was once asked why he had a horseshoe over his door. And it says, you don't believe it in luck, do you? It says, no, but it brings you luck whether you believe in it or not. Do you have any comments from the silent end of the table there?
That's what you're blown away.
Sure.
I think the anesthesia condition, Stephen, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are pain centers in the brain. There are different centers in the brain. We talk about neurons and neuronal activity. It depends upon where it is. We don't know if the neuronal activity or the juxtaposition of neuronal activity creates different impulses, which create different actions.
Are you talking about local or general?
Yeah, no, I'm talking about general.
General anesthesia.
So the point is that there are certain pain centers, and I believe that some of the anesthetics function by slowing down the neural transmission in those centers. Why they actually work, I don't know, certainly.
Yeah, what I was addressing was, I don't know why we lose consciousness. Because we don't really even know what consciousness is, or where it's localized, or if it's localized, or why we lose it every night.
Well, the question is, consciousness part of the mind? Does the mind go away when there's lack of consciousness? And I think the other discussions are whether consciousness, and people are studying consciousness now, saying that without consciousness, there is no mind. But that's because of tautology, you're not sure everyone is.
Well, without brain activity, when you're flatlined, there's no consciousness, right?
Well, those of us who've seen and faced with death in person, you see that there's more than just the absence of cardiac muscle contraction.
Neurological action.
What disappears is something you would call life. Mind is in that. And it's a very striking phenomenon when you're faced with it, because you can put your finger on the cardiac, you put your finger on the cardiogram, you put your finger on the electroencephalogram, and you see that stops, but it doesn't explain the loss of life itself. And whether that's mind or life, it's a very, it's more penetrating and stimulating and very thought-provoking. It's very emotional at the time that it happens.
Okay, back to the general anesthesia. The anesthesiologists are trying to, there isn't really a good measure of general anesthesia. you know, they look and they say, well, they're not moving. You know, they're not complaining. So they're unconscious. But there's numerous times when people have been saying, well, you know, I got my awareness back before my ability to.
They're paralyzed, but unconscious.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Which
right.
is a terrifying thought. And so they've been trying to improve on this. And, you know, that intrigued me. My degree is in pharmacology. And when I was an undergraduate, the idea was this theory called gas cloth rates. I haven't heard of it for decades, so I presume it's gone by the wayside. But they were at a loss to explain it. They were just...
What was that phrase?
Gas cloth rates.
Is that two words?
That's two
Can
words.
Can you spell them? I don't know what a cloth rate is.
CLATHRATE. Cloth rate.
Oh.
It was a
structural. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Cloth rate. Okay.
I just wanted to say one other thing about the connectivity of the brain, and that is between twins, or a child who's lost a father or a mother, especially a father, at a young age and does not have a relationship with a father, and as they grow, you find out that they've got the same mannerisms. Physical mannerisms, gestures, and whatnot, as that dead parrot, or the twins, and that to me is strikingly not. It has to be some kind of genetic transference to the brain to cause that, because they're physical responses, they're physical gestures, and it is bizarre because my husband's father died at 3, and grandmother didn't see him till he was 20 years old, and it was a shock because he had the exact same mannerisms as his father did.
That's not unexpected.
It says more about the amount of information carried on DNA
it's an argument for a physical basis for behavior.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which makes
which
it materialistic again. Mm-hmm. Materialism underlies some behavior or mind.
Yeah. And free will is the a lot of people don't know, is the difference between Presbyterians and Methodists.
David, you're gonna.
I've studied shamanism a great deal because of my very florid dream life, where I get information from the dream that I've not read or I've read. It came from some other dimension, but has made me sort of look at what else is out there beyond what I've studied and learned myself. So I can give examples, hundreds of examples, where the dream delivered poetry, word definitions. So I've wondered about what is this thing that's beyond my own power of reckoning and knowing of what I've read before. So that led me to a shamanistic sort of understanding of the world. I had a dream once that said the shaman, the work of the shaman and rationality are not separate at all, they're the same. The idea being that I think we're in our culture, we're the wide places where we've got these what's extra and what's rational and physical, out there somewhere beyond, like Rumi said, beyond the field of right and wrong, there's a field, meet me there. There's something out there that integrates this all. So I think this is really great that we're discussing this mind and brain, because it's obviously something we do not understand yet. It may come to a philosophical understanding later on, but it's not here yet. And so it takes all these approaches to come back and say, you know, I mean, we haven't talked about the dreams here, but the dreams for those of us that have that as a major part of their life have a huge data to deal with that we're not talking about here. So,
Sunday.
Well, the physical explanation would say that's your unconscious mind. And I think somebody mentioned they're studying consciousness. They're also studying the unconscious. And we're realizing the unconscious is far more vast than we understand. That the consciousness that we consider self, that we're aware of, is just a tiny fraction of what activity is going on in there. And we can all experience that. Every time you look at an optical illusion, essentially your unconscious mind has pre-interpreted it and is delivering to you the conclusion. I don't know if you've ever seen the one with the chessboard and part of it's in shadow, and there's two squares that look to you like light gray and dark gray, but by various means you can see that they're actually exactly the same shade, but your mind has pre-interpreted the thing in the shadow must be actually a lighter shade.
That's right.
That's a very striking one.
It's in a shadow. Yeah. And you, once you know it, you cannot override it.
Yeah.
You cannot override what your unconscious mind is telling you. You can't see those two as the same without blocking out the context.
Yeah.
You can't do it. Your unconscious mind is pre-interpreting, it's deciding what you're going to become aware of. It holds all sorts of information. You don't know, you know. All sorts, you know. So I have to say that, to me, that is the most fascinating thing going on right now, is the free will thing. The unconscious mind, they can tell by neuroimaging, has made decisions before it makes your conscious mind aware of it.
Right.
The most simple example of that is you touch something hot and you jerk your hand away. And if you ask somebody, why did you do that? Why did you jerk your hand away? They say, because it felt hot and I pulled my hand away. Well, they know that neurologically, your hand was, you know, 2 feet away before your conscious mind registered hot. Because there's one neural circuit that says, that doesn't even hit the brain. It just goes up your spinal cord and says, get your hand away from that. It's recognized the hot. And then it comes to your conscious mind and says, that was hot, so you don't try to touch it again.
But you can change
it. But your mind juggles it and tells you, your conscious mind, I detected it was, your conscious mind must take all the credit. I detected it was hot, and that was why you pulled your hand away. But they know from neuroimaging that that's not what happened. That there's two things going on, and that your awareness happened. Your awareness happened tenths of a second, a very long period of time neurologically after you pulled your hand away.
Well, you can dispute that by, we had in physics, had to draw a graph on our hand, and then a partner would hit it with a needle. And it was either a cold needle or a hot needle, and after a while you couldn't discern the difference.
Yeah, well,
that's a question of sensation. The question of
I don't care about that anymore. Your unconscious mind is pre-filtering. What do you need to be consciously aware of, and what do you not?
Well, I use
and you can't override.
Yeah.
There's sometimes you can override it, but the majority of time
you can
override it.
Because we have, I've said this remark before, and I use it in a lecture. That we have an old adage, if I hadn't seen it, I wouldn't have believed it. Where the reality is, if I hadn't believed it, I wouldn't have seen it.
Yes, that's absolutely true, because your unconscious mind decides ahead of time. There's something called pre-sight. They use this in police shootings, that if the policeman has evaluated the person and expects them to be carrying a gun, and they see anything in their hand, they literally see it as a gun, and they shoot. Because the mind is preconceived, that's going to keep you safer than if I let you wait and see what it really is.
You know,
your unconscious mind wants to keep you safe. It doesn't care whether you're happy. It doesn't care whether you make, you know, it's trying its best to. So anyway, that's, I'm just saying that there's this whole other thing going on beyond our consciousness that we don't really know that much about yet, but it's all physical.
Speaking of things that I've learned in the last 30 years, one of the most striking things is that the development of the neurons in the brain is not about making connections, but evaporating and dissolving connections. You come into the world with everything connected, and it's like what Aldous Huxley called the bubbling, booming babble of everything coming in. And what you do during the first probably 15 years is dissolving
down.
Dissolving connections.
Right.
But the other thing is that another really recent thing is myelin. I don't know, maybe you read about that.
Sure.
That where the nerve sheaths are actually being wrapped in the, you know, that myelin is what you don't have when you have multiple sclerosis. It's what's starting to break down. And that every time the circuit travels that same path, it gives you another wrap. Travels it again, it gives you another wrap. And the whole idea of that wrap is to isolate that nerve thing so it can travel much faster without any interference from anything else and always reach the same point. Like when you're learning to play the piano or anything you learn to do without having to think about it anymore, it's because of myelin.
Huh.
You know, so, and that's also what's going on. Your brain is myelinating, and it doesn't complete that until your mid-20s, which is why your impulse control is so bad until you're in your mid-20s. That's another very observable thing.
You know, I think as John said, you know, it's so staggeringly complex for us to sit around and make generalizations about.
About
things is extremely difficult. Our language is not sufficient, and it borders on thought experiments. If we could measure every, you know,
but I want to make a
spark.
I want to make a couple of points about brain chemistry. The drug industry has been very successful. A lot of drugs. do a lot of good. The idea that some have, that all mental illness can be solved by fixing brain problems, whether that statement is true or false, is very important. It's very, and there's no consensus on it. There are scientists who want to treat all mental illness by treating the brain, and much is accomplished by doing that. And there are others who are saying we must do more than that. That conversation out there is affecting a lot of people. And that's it's nice to have a discussion here, but out in the real world, if we've got thousands of people with the wrong model of what the mind is, administering mental health services, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just theory, it's affecting a lot of people.
But most mental health professionals say, whatever you do, it's affecting the brain. Talk therapy changes the brain.
Sure.
I mean, they know that.
But what I'm zeroing in on are those who are advocating a brain-based solution, period, full stop.
But I'm saying,
And
I'm
I would submit that's harmful. But that's my opinion.
What is the alternative?
Inadequate.
Yeah.
That's the right question. That's the right question. Let's answer it.
Behavior modification.
I think she asked you, Jim.
Behavior modification makes the brain.
There are many answers to the question.
Yeah.
Why?
Meditation.
Meditation affects the brain. They can do neuroimaging. They can see growth.
The meditation changes the brain.
It's
a good example of the mind changing the brain.
The mind.
Yeah.
Well, it's the brain generating mind to change itself.
Right.
Which
right.
is bizarre.
Yeah.
But the impulse has to come.
I'd say PTSD,
outside.
Post-traumatic stress disorder, is an example of a mental phenomenon changing the brain.
Yes.
You have an experience,
mm-hmm.
and your brain has changed forever.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's the other direction.
But they can see the change. They can see the actual structures changing.
But it didn't happen from a material cause. It happened from a psychological experience.
Well, that happened from input coming in that caused a physical reaction in your brain that changed the structure of the brain. So I see everybody's going, how can this thing with no substance affect things? Well, think about gravity. What is gravity?
It's
no
a whole other subject.
It's like, how do we ever conceive of this immaterial thing causing physical, influencing things physically, and yet it does. We don't know how it does.
At a distance.
Right. How do you pull without a rope?
But the experience of PTSD, I mean, there is, you have to experience physically that something happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
Be it through sight, sound.
Your retina has to be impacted. Your eardrums have to be impacted. Your brain will be a change.
Your recognition of the futility of your situation.
I think it takes more than the physical mortality.
Hmm?
I think it takes more than the physical.
Yeah.
If you were in a hypnotized state and just not actually experiencing any of this, I don't think you'd have a PTSD.
That's what I'm saying. What's the definition of physical? Is gravity physical?
Well, yes.
It's as far as we're concerned, it's without substance.
Well, we don't have to confuse physical and material. Physical is a little bit bigger than material. Material means matter to most people, but physical includes energy, form, time, space.
So something had to act on your brain to create that PTSD.
Yes.
I mean, it could have been a hallucination. It doesn't have to be something that really happened.
I'm still not sure about this attitude about the brain and I really believe that there's a disconnect between the brain and the mind, that you can push the mind into another space.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, I suffered PTSD.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So what does it mean when you say you push the mind into another space?
Just laying back, concentrating, and pushing it out away from the experience. I had to do it a lot. The PTSD would hit at strange times. I'd be perfectly happy at a dinner, but all of a sudden it would hit. And then I'd have to go out and then push my mind away into another space. Mm-hmm. And that would calm everything down. And then I could function again. And
successful way to deal with it, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Someone intervened or helped you or you helped yourself.
No,
and suddenly you learned how to do that.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Sure,
from
great.
A teenager living in a bad experience that I would push my mind.
You were
mind
a teenager or you learned from a teenager?
Uh-huh. I was a teenager once, but 40 years ago, 60 years ago, I was a teenager. Maybe.
Make your mind up. 40 years ago, 60 years ago, come on.
You're my friends.
But I was able to self-hypnotize myself in a home environment that was stressful and push my mind into another place and just absolutely see myself up in the corner. And it would... I didn't talk about it for years because it was never spoken about, and I was afraid that people thought I would be schizophrenic. And until a friend mentioned a book by a French woman, The Other Woman I Am, and she experienced the same thing and what she did, and what she did when she came out of it, because when I come out of it, I would convulse about three times. And then really I was comfortable and calm. And so what I was doing to myself was relieving myself of a stressful situation. But I could put myself in North Carolina or someplace else and just push my mind out.
Well, and it sounds like a mind over matter.
Yeah, it was a mind of my own.
A recommendation, a book by Robert Wright, who was
Robert Wright.
Yeah.
The political guy?
It's a new book. It's called Why Buddhism is True. And it is completely about the science of the mind and how they're discovering how meditation affects the mind.
You know,
it's
also
it's super intriguing.
It also works as Xanax, you know.
Yeah. What?
It takes about 20 minutes.
Vitamin X.
Yeah. But I refused it. I refused it. Anything like
it's
that.
Called popular here.
You don't need that. You can
works
do it
like
on your own. You know? Because the idea of Xanax and our lifespan and these medications coming in, I think what happened in major surgery when I was 26, and I did not come out of the anesthesia. And I realized I had no control, but again, I heard everything that was going on. And I was comfortable. And my husband was telling the doctor, yell at her something that'll concern her to make her breathe. And Don kept yelling at me, and Terry's got the chicken pox.
Did it work?
No, I didn't care. It was his problem, not mine. And I just had this floating, really nice, calm situation. But I realized coming out of it, and this is during the 60s, the early 60s with LSD and stuff like that, that I was not in control. And I said I would never take anything ever that would make me lose control. And so I don't believe it.
I don't know whether in the 60s you were ever told that if you take LSD, you will be getting flashbacks for the rest of your life.
Oh, yes, we
have.
Yeah.
Still waiting.
Right.
It's been the biggest disappointment of my life. I thought I was making an investment, but it was just a one-time charge.
My kids had five fingers. We were told they'd have six or seven fingers.
The poet
words were said, mankind is driven forward by dim apprehensions too obscure for existing language.
Says a lot.
Well, an hour and a half is up.
Yeah.
We're welcome to hang around.
There's a
two-for-one group meets at 6 o'clock for us alcoholics that like cheap booze. Don't forget to pay your bill. Oh, Don, did you have a...
I was going to say, this was more or less a formal debate. Don't
we
get a chance to vote on the
mirror? Oh, that would be genius. I promised John we wouldn't have a vote. We're both winners for participating,
yeah.
Right? Isn't that what
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
They give all the kids a trophy for showing up at soccer.
Yes,
you
yes,
know?
Yay.
But anyway, I want to make an announcement. I want to make an announcement for the next meeting when Charles will be making the presentation. Charles, do you have any recommendations for us to
sure.
You know,
yes, I think the LCS library has several books on the subject under category 978.931. I've contributed 4 DVDs to the video library on the subject. You can see Tom there and check out any of those.
Is one loose change, is that?
No. Loose change is not there. However, I will be bringing
okay.
DVD copies for everyone of Loose Change.
Okay. Is there anything you can say that succinctly, you know, I'm sure you've got a passion for this. The rest of us may not share and obviously our time's limited. So is there anything that could succinctly sum up the ones who believe that the official explanation is insufficient or needs re-examining or whatever.
The only succinct thing I could say, which I think everyone here would agree with once looking into the evidence, is that everything that happens is a violation of the laws of physics.
Okay, well, that's going to be an interesting talk for next week. So we also need, not from your side, but I think it's quite easy to find Google other sites that would refute your claims.
You will, including some distinguished engineering groups. However, there is a
Okay. What I'm more interested in, we're a very evidence-based group. But we're an evidence-based group. You know, what is the evidence for this? But obviously...
We'll hear.
Yeah, so we'll have... Yeah.
I want to
Well, I'm just hoping everybody comes informed on both sides where we can... And with that, I'm going to turn off. Bye, Henry.